I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on the show, we're kickstarting the holiday season with a program about celebrating the holidays in an urban environment. We'll speak with Cindy Gatziolas of the Chicago Mayor's Office of Special Events, and she'll tell us about the city's plans for the holidays and how a city works with private organizations to make the season bright. Then, what's Christmas in the city without a Christmas carol? We'll speak with sound designer Lindsay Jones about bringing the sounds of Charles Dickens' London to life in the theater world. And we'll have a lineup of our own ghost of Christmas past. We've brought back some of our favorite past guests and friends of the show to discuss their holiday plans and what makes the city such a special place to celebrate this time of year. We'll have our regular contributors, Nate Berg of Planetizen, and our City Views commentator, Walker Smith. Stick around for today's very merry episode of Smart City right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Each year around this time, cities all over the world plan special holiday events to celebrate the season. In Chicago, most of the planning and coordinating for these events falls on the shoulders of the Mayor's Office of Special Events. The office is responsible for producing and programming year-round family-style entertainment such as festivals, lunchtime concerts, and parades. But starting around mid-November, the office goes into overtime getting the entire city ready to celebrate the holiday season. Cindy Gatziolas is the spokesperson for the Mayor's Office of Special Events. How does the city of Chicago celebrate the holiday season?
Chicago celebrates the holidays in a multitude of ways. We have several city agencies such as Greater North Michigan Avenue, which just lit all the trees along Michigan Avenue. But we, here at the City of Chicago, we decorate City Hall, and then we put the giant Christmas tree up at Daley Plaza along with Santa's house. And we've also invited friends at the German-American Chamber of Commerce to put up the Chris Kindle Market.
You, in effect, have two parades.
Well, yes, there's two different groups that put that parade on. The Festival of Lights, which just occurred, is Greater North Michigan Avenue. And then there's Chicago Festival Association puts on the parade Thanksgiving Day that takes place on State Street. And on that day is when we do a little sneak preview. Santa Claus is open for business from 11 to 4, as is the market, the Chris Kindle Market.
Have you ever considered trying to get the groups to cooperate and have one parade?
Well, they're two very different parades. The Michigan Avenue one is really about lighting up the street and making it look decorated for the holiday. And the other is more of a true parade with floats and marching bands and entertainment and the big giant balloons. So that's more traditional, like the one you see out of New York every year.
When it comes to the holiday celebrations, how many organizations does the city partner with to make these events happen?
Not actually a partnership. Those are different organizations that put those things together. They do work closely with the city in terms of we have a parade coordinator on staff who makes sure they do all their permits, and they make sure they work with the Chicago Police Department and the emergency management and traffic management so that everything is done correctly. In that sense, the two parades work very closely with different city agencies. Any other decorations is really done more of a chamber level.
I've wondered, in a time of budget cuts, which this is, does the conversation ever occur, how do we cut out Christmas?
Well, we never want to cut out Christmas. That's just too special a time of year. But we encountered a little snag this year in that we typically would do the Christmas tree lighting on the day following Thanksgiving, but that's a partial government shutdown that day, so we've moved that to December 2nd. So we're hoping to move it back next year, but December 2nd at noon, we're going to be lighting the Christmas tree. So that budget situation has affected that, but we're also partnering with Underwriter Laboratories, and they're going to be paying for our LED lights. And then LED lights are more efficient. They'll burn less electricity, and they'll have a longer life. They don't break down. They don't have to be replaced. So, you know, we're working. We're making the best of the situation, and it's going to end up being a beautiful Christmas. And we also recycle our ornaments. So that's something. You'll have the same ornaments as last year, and they look just as beautiful this year.
Well, now tell me, a lighting of a Christmas tree at noon?
Yes, the LED lights actually burn brighter, but I think most people forget that a lot of time they're walking through the plaza at daytime, or the Saturday and Sunday shoppers are there at daytime, and they see a beautifully lit Christmas tree. So while it's a little different at night, and you do like the night sky against it, it looks just as beautiful in the daytime.
Ah. Well, so many of the usual holiday traditions are centered around suburban lifestyles. I mean, I think even of Miracle on 34th Street, where mom had her daughter overlooking the parade in the New York high-rise, but Nirvana was to move to the house that Kris Kringle found for them in the suburbs. And so we always think of the snow on the picket fences and Santa Claus coming down the chimney. So what is it that makes Christmas in the city special?
I think it's probably the people. More than anything, it's still exciting to be downtown and shopping. The lights everywhere, the decorations everywhere, just the hustle bustle. I think hustle bustle is part of the holiday season just as much as the white picket fence.
Do you have a favorite event or favorite Christmas memory in the city?
Well, I always came to see the big Christmas tree at Daly Plaza, and then it was the windows at the old Marshall Field store. Those were two of the most special things that we used to do as children.
We live, of course, as you know, in a more politically aware age, some might say a more politically sensitive age. What are the challenges in creating holiday celebrations that are culturally diverse?
Well, we actually look at the Christmas tree as being has become almost a secular. We tend to stay away, obviously, from the religious aspect of the holiday. But because the plaza is an open public space, you'll find one organization has put out a nativity scene, another organization puts out the menorah, and then we have the crescent.
When you make your case for what the city is going to do for Christmas, do you think of it more as geared toward bringing people into the city or events geared toward residents of the city?
Well, everything that the Mayor's Office of Special Events does, our first tier is to make a better place to live. But secondarily, we want it to be a great place to visit. And you look at it that if your first customer are the folks who live here, they're going to invite friends and family to come on and see their great city and come for a wonderful festival, whether it's for blues music or the Taste of Chicago, or to come see our Christmas tree and see our Santa Claus and our Kris Kindle Market.
You produce an enormous number of events every year. How many events do you do?
I'd say it's about two dozen major events, and then there's always little small things that either pop up or we're part of previews for our existing events that take place on the plaza. But the majors is about two dozen.
What makes someone a good special events producer?
Very detail-oriented. It's like you have to use both right and left brain because you have to be creative, but then you have to have the really orderly, organized part of you, too. So you really have a good mesh of those two skills.
And how do you sort through what you're going to do versus, say, the Office of Cultural Affairs and Tourism?
Our office is probably charged more with the more wide-scale appeal to the masses events, whereas Cultural Affairs is a little bit more niche-oriented. Tourism is there to actually help promote all of our events all across the country and then across internationally as well.
How many lights are on that giant tree in Daly Plaza?
9,000 red, green, and white energy-saving LED lights.
It sounds like you've rehearsed that a few times.
No,
energy-saving LED lights.
I think it's great. I read somewhere that we're going to use 87% less electricity. I think that's marvelous.
Wow, that is impressive. Well, where do all the decorations go when they're not out making our streets merry?
They go out to the North Pole, of course.
Well, okay, that's one version of the story. What's the real version of the story?
We have a place to store everything. We have a warehouse that a number of things are stored. So Santa's house will get taken apart and put up there and brought out again next year.
And how much of it is usable for, you know, in the next year? How much of it do you say, it's broken, can't be used? That must be kind of a sad thing.
Well, the goal really is to try to preserve for as many years as we can. As I said, the ornaments are recycled from last year. But prior to that, we'd probably done about 5 or 6 years with the old ornaments. So, you know, you hope for a life of about 5 or 6 years. That's really all we can ask out of things that are out in the elements for a good month and a half.
Well, you said this year you added LED lights. Is there anything else new for Christmas? When you sit around thinking, what can we do new for Christmas? Or do you just say, let's produce the same thing because people love it? It's tradition.
We'll change things here and there. The fountain gets turned off, and then there's a little display there, which this year I think is elevated a little higher from last year, so it's a little more three-dimensional. And that's just holiday scenes and sort of a storybook land there. The ornaments were changed last year. They're these beautiful lighted snowflakes that look so pretty on the tree, along with the balls and spears. So that was new from last year. But yeah, you know, you're always looking to see where you can just maybe alter a little bit, hopefully not spending more dollars. And this year, of course, we were looking not to spend more dollars and looking to spend less. So the upgrades were done a little bit last year. The lights, I think, will be the big difference. I think people will really see a much brighter tree.
Cindy, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City, and Merry Christmas.
Same to you. Merry Christmas.
Cindy Gatziolis is the spokesperson for the Mayor's Office of Special Events in Chicago. To see a full list of all the holiday events she told us about, head to our website, smartcityradio.com.
My name is Harriet Tregoning, and I'm the Director of Planning in Washington, D.C. My favorite thing about the holidays in Washington is that there's great holiday music. Certainly things at the National Symphony, but one of my favorite things is the Gay Men's Chorus, which is fun and campy and really participatory, which is wonderful. And they do a holiday program every year. It's so lighthearted. I really like it. We have the benefit of all the great local things that any city has, but we're also the nation's capital. So we have some national things that happen here that kind of make the holidays even more special. One of those things is we have an absolutely immense Christmas tree, the national Christmas tree that gets lit usually the first week in December on the Ellipse, not too far from the White House. And there are a total of 56 additional trees. They're small compared to the national Christmas tree, but each one of them is immense, much larger than would get in any normal house, and all individually decorated by every state and territory and the District of Columbia. So that's a very cool thing to walk down to see. We also have a lot of embassies in Washington. At the last count, something like 180 embassies and foreign missions, and many of those embassies host parties or host events around the city that are representative of how the holidays are celebrated in their country. One of my favorite things is Norway. Does a whole Norwegian Christmas at Union Station that includes trees and beautiful twinkly white lights and a model train set that goes through like the Norwegian mountains and all over the place, and it's also just really, really fun. Kids love it, but I hate to say, I think adults love it even more. The other thing I really love about holidays in the city is the store windows. I'm a bike commuter, and I usually ride my bike most times of the year to and from work, but I have to say, even today, I deliberately didn't do it because I was going to take the metro to a downtown stop and then walk the rest of the way home so that I could walk by the Shoppers and walk by the holiday windows. And it's just very exciting, whether you're actually planning on doing a lot of shopping yourself or you just want to see how people have gussied up their displays and their stores for the holidays. It's a very, very wonderful thing. Now, I have to confess that I used to go to New York for this thrill. And, you know, I'd be one of those people that would be in the train station coming home with more shopping bags than really could be physically carried by one person. My arms would bristle with shopping bags. It was crazy. But I've come to get my thrills more in my own city. The shopping downtown is really great, and we have a lot of wonderful, creative, local merchants who do a fantastic job at the holidays. And, you know, and there's something really wonderful about going to a merchant, going to a store that really knows its customers and really knows what people like in a particular neighborhood, remember you. And you know that your dollar is circulating in the local economy, which is a really great thing, especially this year. We're not a city that gets a lot of snow, but there is really nothing more beautiful than Washington after a really big snowstorm. It's absolutely gorgeous with all of the monumental buildings and the broad avenues. It's just so incredibly beautiful. But unfortunately, we don't get as much snow as I'd like and are rarely fortunate enough to have it right around the holidays. We usually get it a little bit later. But we do have some great skating around the city in a couple of very wonderful places. The National Gallery has a sculpture garden, and it's a beautiful place in the summer and the spring, but in the winter, it becomes this outdoor skating emporium where there's music and there's lights. I think if you were to put that ice skating rink out on 120 acres somewhere kind of in the middle of nowhere, it would never have the vitality and the excitement that it has in the middle of the city, surrounded by wonderful Beaux-Arts marble buildings. And I would say many more people come to watch the skaters than actually come to skate. So, you know, there's always just a lot of people around, you know, enjoying the season and enjoying the, you know, all the activity downtown.
That was Harriet Tregoning, the Director of Planning for Washington, D.C. We'll have more holiday remembrances from past guests and friends of Smart City in the second half of the show. While Chicago lights up its huge Christmas tree, the fictional city has its own holiday traditions. R.J. White is the editor of thecitydesk.net, a site dedicated to covering a fictional urban environment. R.J. brings us this latest piece on the holiday traditions of his made-up city.
Yes, it's that time of the year again, when the downtown and central corridor areas of the city come alive for the holidays, humming with shoppers, visitors, and the sights of the season. The windows of Whitestone's department store and the Macy's on Potts Avenue sporting their elaborate displays, Salvation Army Santas ringing their bells on virtually every street corner, the Christmas Village in Memorial Park, the lavishly decorated houses in the President Heights neighborhood, and the J.C.'s Winter Wonderland has even made their annual 13th floor of Halloween Terror attraction in the mostly empty Witherspoon building a dim autumn memory. On East Main, the plaza in front of the headquarters of Quad States Energy Capital Partners, formerly Energonistics, formerly the Municipal Gas Works, is looking rather festive as the Eternaflame natural gas menorah is all ready to be lit. A 10-foot-tall stainless steel set of 9 candles, each topped with what will be a constantly burning flame over Hanukkah. It will join the Eternaflame Christmas tree and the Eternaflame Kwanzaa giant ear of corn and casting an eerie bluish-white light and hiss over the utilities building. Those worried about any wasted energy will be glad to know that this year's holiday flames will utilize Quad State's ECP's new ConservJet technology, more information about which can be found in the building's ground-level energy store and info center, open until 8 p.m. through the holiday season. The fact that it's even lit at all this year comes as a relief after last year's lackluster show, with several gas jet outages and worries about the utility's contentious merger possibly putting the kibosh on this year's display. It's impressive, sure, but the main attraction downtown is, as always, the city's official holiday festival tree, which stands tall and proud on the barren concrete plaza between Old City Hall and the City Hall Annex. On a cold evening a few nights ago, 3,000 or so people bundled up and gathered together on the windswept concrete plain to view the tree lighting ceremony with all of its usual trappings, speeches by dignitaries, a stiff emceeing job from a local television news host, Carla Perry, from News Center 7's Hello Morning, and the 57th annual tree lighting ceremony performance by the senior choir from Central High School. Coincidentally, the tree lighting was also the 57th consecutive public appearance at which outgoing Mayor Joseph Wilders made a joke about calling his old buddy, Channel 6 meteorologist Rick Mellors, and ordering up some good weather. It was also the 57th time an assembled crowd sort of almost laughed politely. Somehow, without making any eye contact whatsoever, Mayor Wilders and Mayor-elect Mary Beth Cosgrove together threw the ceremonial switch, and the holiday festival tree came to life, this year powered for the first time by thousands of twinkling LED bulbs. Every speaker at the ceremony hailed the lighting change as green, efficient, and forward-thinking. They also offered up many variations on the technology's name, including LDE, LDD, LLD, LED, DL, LEED, and our personal favorite, these magic bulbs. According to the city, the new bulbs are supposed to save 1,000 kilowatt hours a day of energy throughout the holiday season. But if you miss the old energy inefficient strings of tree lights, you can always go and see them decorating the outside of the Faulkner Municipal Maintenance Garage on Park Street. Now, as for the tree itself, well, there's a lot you can say about it. You could say it's very tall, 49 feet. You could say it's very Teutonic, Austrian pine. And you could say it'll be very bright. Over 8,000 of the aforementioned LEDs, according to a press release from the city manager's office. But the local media has also dubbed the tree the Survivor. You see, it was first harvested 24 years ago and used as a Christmas tree in the living room of Harry and Beatrice Darren, who live out in the Kings Point borough of the city. After that holiday, they decided to try planting it in their rather sizable yard, and were surprised when it seemed to thrive. But then came the garage fire in 1989. A few worries and some branches singed, but the tree kept growing. Then, in 1985, came the bad parasite scare, and things looked a bit dire. But the Darrens nursed it back to health, and the tree held on. Next came the drunk driver in an SUV in early 2004. But after the rental of some heavy equipment to ride it, the tree was fine, except for some damage to the trunk. This year, when officials from the city asked for the tree for this year's holiday celebrations, cutting off the first 4 feet where the Escalade hit it, of course, the Darrens were honored and glad that they had cared for it for so long. So tonight, and through the rest of the holidays, this tree, which has been through so much, will attract tens of thousands to the plaza of Old City Hall and serve as a shining symbol of the season, of peace, tradition, and joy. Then, after it's taken down on January 3rd, it'll be ground into mulch to be used on Parks and Rec Department playgrounds this summer. The public is welcome to come and watch. Happy holidays.
R.J. White wrote and performed that piece. He's the editor of thecitydesk.net. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
It is a confusing time for cities, and for the people who work for them. On one hand, the recent election showed a groundswell of support for new investment in infrastructure and a renewed interest in the future of America's urban places. But at the same time, cities are facing mounting fiscal problems as the double wave of the mortgage crisis and the economic recession hits the shore. While greater investment appears to sit just over the horizon, right now, many cities are being forced to make tough decisions about where to cut services. Officials are understandably worried about what it will mean to have less money to keep their cities moving. But cutting back doesn't necessarily have to mean dark days ahead for cities. One way to think about it is streamlining. In a recent column on CityWire, Neil Pierce writes that the best place to cut back funding is in those areas that use the most money. Sounds good, but for most cities, those areas are public safety services like police and firefighters, not the most politically popular places to be taking away money. But don't be so fast to put the kibosh on those cuts, Pierce argues. By improving the efficiency of these safety operations, he says cities can cut budgets and still maintain high levels of service. And though it might seem like public safety is playing the scapegoat here, there's evidence to back the claim up. When the city of Vallejo, California declared bankruptcy this spring, it was largely due to ballooning salaries and benefits for public safety employees like cops and firefighters. Nearly 75% of the city's general fund went towards these services, and the rising cost of providing pensions for retirees rapidly became too much for the city to handle. According to a recent article in Governing Magazine, bankruptcy was the unfortunate solution for Vallejo. But many other cities in similar situations are looking towards the city for guidance, mainly on what not to do. But Vallejo's tough lesson about the need to deal with public employee pay and benefits may turn out to be a good thing overall. Now that cities have seen what can happen if the problem gets out of hand, they can act sooner to prevent it from happening. The true lesson is that cities will need to rethink their funding structures now if they're going to be able to survive through these tough economic times. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. We've got some Christmas cheer in store. Smart City producer Scotty Iseri brings us the creepiest sounds of the season you'll ever hear. Plus more from our past guest about their favorite holiday traditions and memories coming up after this short break. You're listening to Smart City. With me is our producer, Scotty Iseri, and we're trying to encourage podcast listening.
We have a great podcasting audience. We have thousands of people that download our show every week. And we thought, since we have all these smart people that are sending us comments, maybe they'd like to talk to each other. So we have this social networking site called My City, and we'd like to invite you, the podcasting listener, to join us online.
It's so valuable to me, and not only in producing the show, but in doing the work I do at CEOs for Cities, to hear from people who are on the ground in cities all over the world, what's going right in those cities, what concerns them about their cities, how cities are meeting challenges in ways that are unexpected that more people need to know about. So I would love for people to get to know each other through My City, but I'd like to know what people are seeing in their cities that they think we ought to be aware of and what ought to be shared.
How selfish of you.
What can I say? But it is a great way for us to hear from listeners, and you can be so useful to us and to people all over the world who care about cities and care about making them better. So I hope you'll participate.
Shoot me an email, Scotty, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com. Scotty@smartcityradio.com, and I'll send you an invite. Join us online.
And we'll see you there. You're listening to Smart City, and I'm Carol Coletta. From the Nutcracker to the Radio City Music Hall Christmas Spectacular, it's not the holiday season without a trip to the theater. Many theater companies have a holiday offering in their season's lineup, including several variations on that perennial Christmas in the City classic, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. But who's in charge of recreating the sounds of a Dickensian city? Our producer, Scotty Iseri, spoke with Lindsay Jones, a sound designer who wants to make the ghost of Christmas frighteningly real.
Lindsay Jones, thank you for joining us on Smart City.
Thanks for having me.
You are a sound designer.
Yes.
What does a sound designer do?
A sound designer in the world of theater is responsible for all of the sound effects and soundscapes that might be heard in the show, as well as system design, how you would hear the sounds through speakers and how they might be laid out. And in certain cases, if there needs to be actors who need to be on microphones or there are instruments that need to be mic'd, a sound designer would be also responsible for setting up those systems and sort of overseeing anything that you hear in the theater. That comes under the responsibility of the sound designer.
So I wanted to talk to you because you have designed the play A Christmas Carol here in Chicago, the Goodman Theater, for many years.
Yes, I have.
What exactly does a Dickensian city sound like?
That's a great question. It's mostly in the Goodman's production, at least the one that I designed a couple of years ago. It really was the sounds of Christmas carols and wind, and it's a cold place, but people seem to be happy within it. That's basically what the city sounds like. And then, of course, we quickly leave what the real Dickensian city sounds like to go into the really isolated life of Ebenezer Scrooge. And from there, it just gets worse and worse.
How do you mean worse and worse?
Well,
and we all know the story, but
yeah, if you remember, what happens is the ghost of Jacob Marley shows up. And for my particular design of Jacob Marley, it really was that he was coming from this unseen spirit world back to get a hold of Ebenezer and tell him of what this night holds for him. And so as a result, I created this design that was that Marley had managed to escape briefly the spirit world in order to warn Scrooge of it. And so you hear the voices of the other spirits sort of coming to get Marley and bring him back to the spirit world where he belongs. So it is not at all a friendly place. And I would say it's probably my favorite moment in all of Christmas Carol, and probably one of my favorite sounds of Christmas, which is, you know, in Christmas Carol, there's a good 8 to 10 minutes of exposition as they set up the whole story of where we are and what's going on. And usually during that time, any child under the age of 13 has almost completely fallen asleep. They've given up on the play. They really just want to go. And they're like, oh, this is just going to be the most boring Christmas show of all time. And then Jacob Marley shows up. And what happens is you have a 50% divide in between the children. 50% of the children are completely eyes bugged out of their heads, sitting on the edge of their seat, watching this ghost that they had no idea was showing up. And then usually there's another 50% of children who are saying loudly, "Mommy, I want to go home. Please let me go home. I don't want to be here. I'm frightened." And so to me, that's the sounds of Christmas, is hearing children scream, "Mommy, I want to go home."
And you know you've done your job well.
I do. And I have to say, I really feel like for a lot of children who come to see A Christmas Carol, in many ways, that's their first theatrical experience. It's their first real interaction in the theater. And it's always such a real treat for me to see these children who come in with the attitude of boring, this is really dull. And then within 10 minutes, they're electrified one way or the other. And I think that it hopefully will inspire them to see more theater in the future and find other plays that affect them similarly.
Well, let's hear what that sounds like. Let's hear Jacob Marley. That would definitely terrify me.
Pretty good. I have to say, it warms my heart to hear that.
So you go from this, I'm assuming the sounds of the city are fairly realistic, and then you go into this very fantastic, sort of phantasmagoric place for the majority of the play.
Well, you really do. In The Christmas Carol, some of the great elements of it, of course, is that after Marley leaves, you have the thing where Scrooge falls asleep and we get to watch the clock reset itself. So one of the great things is you hear the sound of this grandfather clock ticking, and then it slowly starts to echo itself out, and it sounds like the clock is winding itself 100 different ways, and then bing, we're in this new place. And then we hear the appearance of the ghost of Christmas Past, who is this very sweet and likable Christmas ghost who's flying in, and so you hear the sound of wind, and you also hear the sound of beautiful music, and you really are like, oh, this is the friendly ghost. And then from there we move into the ghost of Christmas Present, who is a really jolly ghost. He's kind of like Santa Claus in a way, and he's very happy, and he's all about Christmas cheer. And then of course finally we get to the ghost of Christmas Future, who, again, if any child has not been scared by Jacob Marley in the first half of the play, big guns come out for the Ghost of Christmas Future, and hopefully there is not a dry seat in the house by the time he's shown up, because this really is the moment in which Ebenezer Scrooge learns his lesson. And I've always really been of the theory about A Christmas Carol, which is that, you know, you can't really change your ways unless you've really been faced with the seriousness of it and really been scared to death, which is what happens in Christmas Carol. And I've always thought, like, if you're going to have the Ghost of Christmas Future and he's going to basically forever change your ways of thinking things, the sound really needs to support that. So it's thunderously loud and really sort of terrifying and is designed to scare the living bejesus out of people. Then hopefully once that sound ends, Scrooge wakes back up on his bed, and then that's when we're back in the Dickensian city all over again, and we're hearing distant church bells and snow outside and joyful caroling people who are really, really glad to be on Christmas Day, and it's now the best day of Ebenezer Scrooge's life.
It sounds like so much fun. What's the hardest part about Christmas Carol for you?
The hardest part is making it all work properly, because it's an extremely complicated design and really it's epic. You know, it's a fairy tale in a lot of ways. And so as a result, you want to immerse the audience in this story and really have them lose themselves in the fantastic fantasy elements that surround it. One of the things we do in the design of it is we make sure that the sound is coming from all areas of the theater, not just in front of you from the stage, but also behind you and around you and above you and all over the place. So you really feel like you're inside, you're really living inside of this story. And so when it works, it's wonderful.
Lindsay Jones, thank you for joining us on Smart City.
Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas.
Lindsay Jones is a composer and sound designer. If you'd like to hear more of his work, we've got a link to his site on our site, smartcityradio.com. So much of the familiar holiday imagery seems to have, well, a suburban theme. Look no further than my favorite movie, Miracle on 34th Street. White picket fences, shoveling a long driveway, even a sooty chimney for Santa to climb down or leave his cane in front of. But with all the wonderful things in the city, we thought we'd ask some former guests and some friends about the things that make celebrating the holidays in the city so delightful.
My name is Diana Lind. I'm the editor of Next American City magazine. I grew up in New York City and lived there for most of my life before moving to Philadelphia. And the best part of Christmas in the city is the way that the city lights up. Even though it's so dark outside, there's so many buildings with lights, Christmas ornaments and displays and everything like that. And between that and the crowds, there's a completely different spirit in the city at that period of time. Our traditions for Christmas have changed over the years. When I was younger, my mother worked pretty near Wall Street, and so we would go visit Santa in the World Trade Center, which is a very different experience than seeing a Santa in along the suburbs. You got a chance to take a look out of Manhattan from the windows. I actually don't even remember Santa that much, but just taking those elevators to see him and all the other kids that were kind of kids of working parents. So it was something that we did even on a weekday. You know, in New York, Christmas is a really hectic time. There's a lot of tourists, and the only way to, I think, really enjoy that is to sort of be a tourist yourself. So we go see, you know, all the major department stores put on these fantastic displays, and we go take a look at the windows. I used to go take a look at the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree and go for a skate in the Rockefeller Center ice rink. And then when we got a little bit older, I think my memories of Christmas in the city would be like carrying a Christmas tree back home, which is, I guess, a little bit different than in the suburbs where you'd, you know, probably drive your tree home. So it was kind of a little bit of an athletic experience carrying the tree back with my dad.
My name is Diego Kolsky. I live and work in New York City. I am Bradfield, a brand consultancy dedicated to branding places and cities. What I find special about the holiday season in New York, there's a sort of like a reversal of roles between the tourists and the locals. You know, people come and visit New York to see us running around and eating our breakfast on the way and eating lunch on the way all year round, but you know, what happens in the holidays, things quiet down here. We get a chance to see the tourists running around, doing their shopping and going to the attractions that the city offers and so forth. So we get to be sort of like outsiders in our city for a little while. You know, I was born in Buenos Aires and my wife is from Rio. So sometimes we go there and visit family for the holiday season. And obviously the main difference is the change in climate. You know, it's summer there when it's winter here. So for the holidays, you get to see Santa Clauses and short sleeves and trunks, basically. And, you know, you eat the wrong type of food for the weather. But the upside is that it's sort of like a hard end to the year. You know, we don't think about it that way. But over there, you get to the summer, and so the vacations start right after New Year's Eve. School ends and so forth. So it's sort of like a really great time because people really put a hard stop to their year and start only like in February, March again with work, school, etc.
My name is Fritz Haig and I'm an artist based in Los Angeles. This year I finished a book called Edible Estates, Attack on the Front Lawn, which was released in March and talks about the possibility for replacing the front lawn with an edible landscape. My memories of growing up in Minneapolis are of a lot of snow, very cold. We were usually spending most of our days outside cross-country skiing or skating and then coming in with numb hands and drinking like hot apple cider or something. I have very vivid memories of a few blizzards that really prevented us from going out very much even. In Minneapolis, we have a lot of parks in the city. We have, Minneapolis is pretty well known for its lakes and its park system that rings the entire city. And there's also a lot of golf courses. So all of that typically has some sort of cross-country ski pass. Near our family, we had a golf course that we went skiing on, but really the city is full of public green spaces that in the winter, I think you can cross-country ski in. You know, I've lived in L.A. for 10 years, and my family's all back in Minneapolis, so those are two very extremely different climates with different situations of growing things. So in L.A., of course, people are growing things all the way through the winter. Right now, I'm in Minnesota, and there's nothing much growing here now. It's certainly possible at the end of the season to grow squash and gourds and pumpkins and things like that that you can keep around for the holidays, certainly. And in L.A., you can be growing things right now. I don't miss the cold, honestly. I think my parameters now for where I live have more to do with being able to garden year-round than anything else. It's a fun novelty to return to it, but on a daily basis, it is a pleasure to go out in December in shorts and a t-shirt and tend to your lettuce and cabbage and you know, winter crops.
This is Terry Montague. I'm president and chief executive officer for Atlanta Beltline, Inc., down in Atlanta, Georgia. The Beltline is a 25-year, $3 billion investment that will transform the city of Atlanta for the next 25 years to create a new public realm, a new greenway of 1,300 acres of green space. That's about 40 new parks. This is actually going to be my first year since moving here to work on the Beltline 2 years ago, where I'm going to be in Atlanta during the Christmas holidays. I usually go travel elsewhere and go see my family, but they're all coming to me. The best thing about holidays in the city is the celebration of art, of history, of community, and in Atlanta, of sports. The Braves, the Falcons, the Hawks, the Thrashers. Atlanta draws the SEC championship football game this time of year, and Christmas Eve, there's the Chick-fil-A Bowl, which is a big college football game. One of the, I think it's the ninth oldest bowl game in college football. So, you know, in Atlanta, because of the mild temperatures, there's a lot of celebrating of arts and community in a lot of creative ways, often in outdoor venues. And I think that's unlike the other cities I've lived in, Chicago, Boston, Washington, D.C. So we do have the mild weather. Centennial Olympic Park also opens up the ice skating rink, and there's Holiday in Lights skating outdoors between November 15th and January 4th, right downtown. And I plan to hang up my inline skates and get out the ice skates and try it. This is a great time of year, and there's also a great volunteer thrust that is well organized in the city of Atlanta through Hands on Atlanta and the United Way, and you know, there's just a lot for everyone to do, and it's very community-oriented, bringing people together, really taking advantage and celebrating community in our public spaces. December 31st, if you happen to be in Atlanta, just like New York has its New York ritual, Atlanta will celebrate its 20th annual peach drop. Downtown, we have Atlanta-style New Year's Eve party downtown, and we have an 800-pound peach that drops to the count of 10 and brings in the new year.
That was Diana Lind, Diego Kolsky, Fritz Haig, and Terry Montague, all friends of Smart City, telling us about their favorite holiday traditions. Finally, this week, did your office exchange gifts this holiday season? Walker Smith has a regular appointment to exchange a gift with a friend, and our City Views commentator says it has little to do with getting and more to do with giving.
Steve and I call it the ritual exchange. He lives in Raleigh. I live in Atlanta. We see each other 3 or 4 times a year. Every time we get together, we sit down, each with a bag at our feet, and take turns giving each other 7 or 8 or 9 of the most obscure CDs or cassettes or LPs that we have been able to find since the last ritual exchange. As you can guess, Steve and I are big music fans. We both have extensive collections, and we are always turning each other on to new bands and new songs. In fact, when I flip through my personal collection, I can see Steve's influence on well over half of it. If it's rock and roll, country, alt-country, bluegrass, or R&B, even some gospel and classical music, Steve and I are always on the prowl at any place, virtual or real, where little-known music can be found. We got started with this in graduate school when it was all about knowing the coolest music around. We've kept it up over the years, though, because it's gotten to be a tradition, something emblematic of our 30-year friendship. It's one of those things about getting older that hits you every now and then. Steve and I have been friends for almost 10 years more than our individual ages when we first met. We never intended to invent some ritual that we would keep up for 3 decades. Indeed, sometimes it feels onerous to have to do some last-minute scrambling for new music to keep from being embarrassed at the next ritual exchange. But it's become an old habit now, one that we are loath to give up. It's not about the music anymore. We both have plenty of that. It's about being friends. I think a lot of our habits, routines, and customs are like that, less about their functional purpose and more about their symbolic meaning. When I was growing up,
I could never understand the purpose of going through the same ritual ceremony every Sunday at church. As an impatient teenager, it seemed to me that once or twice a year would be more than sufficient to check in with God and let Him know that I was repentant and reverential. I got lots of stars in Sunday school, so I figured I was pretty well schooled in what it took to function as a good, obedient Episcopalian. But I was missing the point. I confess that I still don't believe that a weekly service makes me a better member of the Anglican Communion. But I have come to understand and better appreciate the symbolic value of this weekly ritual. For church is about more than theology. It is about community. It is about people, neighbors, family, relationships. It is about being friends. The service each week is as much about community as worship. It is an affirmation of the community that each church represents, and the ritual exchange of time and commitment that we make with one another is the glue that binds us together over time. I suspect that one of the reasons so many of us feel disconnected from others, so much red versus blue, so much east versus west, so much us versus them, is that in our scattered and informal world, we have lost the bond of ritual exchange. Maybe with a little more, we could all draw closer as friends. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, and he comes to us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. So how are your holiday plans shaping up? Do you have some tickets to the Nutcracker? Been downtown to see the holiday displays? Let us know. You can contact us through our website. While you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. You can also send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com or head to our website and click on the contact button, because listener feedback is the greatest gift of all. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and we are very grateful at this time of year for our national distribution that's made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our very grinchy producer and engineer. He lost his MP3 player on the holiday train. Would someone give it back? I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City.